I'm Darren.
And I'm Mindy, and we are The Rants Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of The Rants Macabre, please visit fangoria.com.
So, Guillermo del Toro, for the 9 feature films he's made, he's produced more than 3 times that, and exec produced even more.
Yeah.
So, not just a brilliant artist, he's a champion of great storytelling. So today, using his seal of approval as a sort of guide, we're jumping off to cover 3 of the films that he's produced in the last 10 years. And some are better than others. But,
some are better than others, but his name alone is what like draws me to the films. And so, you know, I think something like Mama, I remember seeing in the theater only because GDT was involved with it. And I go, oh, how bad can that be? But no, his name carries so much weight in America, especially when his name is attached to a project. And I think, especially with Spanish language film, we are kind of only seeing some of his that are brought over. We don't get to see a lot of this film. And so for his name to be attached to it is a great seal of approval for film.
Before we jump into these, it's worth noting that his Spanish language films were just released in a Criterion box set. That's this like gorgeous packaging. So it starts off with Kronos. It's got Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth. And yeah, totally worth a look. I don't buy much physical media anymore these days, so I'm going to miss out on this one. Thankfully, I've got some of the other discs, and so I've got some of the bonus features. But he's taking a direct involvement in sort of curating the content for this box set.
Nice.
So let's jump in. So we're going to start off with 2010's Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
Yeah.
Directed by Troy Nixie. One assumes Guillermo del Toro saw his film Latchkey Lament and wanted to work with him. Latchkey is a combination of live action, CGI, and stop motion animation. It seems like off kilter, fairy tale story kind of stuff. So the story, it was written by Guillermo del Toro and Matthew Robbins, and a credit is given to the original writer of the TV movie it's based on, Nigel McKeand.
Right. That was from 1973, and it's a fun watch.
Yeah, I had first heard Kevin Smith is a big fan, and he talked about it at length in an interview. And I was curious about it. It seems like one of those that doesn't age so well, but at the time on like network television, everybody
it
saw
awesome.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah. And because there's only, you know, maybe 4 channels at the time, it enters into the zeitgeist like overnight.
And then it's on syndication. So it was kind of like the Friday, Saturday movie for a while.
Yeah. So not just the United States, but also a young Guillermo del Toro saw this in Guadalajara, Mexico, and it marked him.
It's a project that Guillermo's been very passionate about since he saw it in his youth. And he's been working on this project for 15 years to bring it to light.
I saw this movie as a kid, and it was, for my generation, it was the scariest TV movie we ever saw. And we used to say to each other, Sally.
Her name is Sally.
While the original still has its moments, the creatures involved, because they're expressionless, they kind of have like a wooden African mask kind of look
to
their head.
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier today on GChat, where we're only allowed to speak now. And I don't know, there was something about like 70s, 80s tiny monsters that always are kind of a little silly. Because I always go back to Trilogy of Terror.
Yeah.
And you're just like, that's kind of silly, you know?
In the original, they play with forced perspective to make them look around 1.5 feet tall.
Right.
And in this new version, there are a couple homages to scenes in that movie. There's a bathroom scene. There's like a sort of gag where the napkin gets pulled under the table. That was in the original. And the device of using the camera flash to scare them off or hurt them. Worth noting, it happened a full 11 years before we'd see that happen in Gremlins.
Right.
So, you know, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, 1973.
And I think of the Horde as well, when I think of camera flashes scaring shit off.
Oh, okay.
That's one of the things they do in that film. Yeah, no, it's a great film, though. I like it. I love little tiny scary monsters. These guys are much smaller than the original movie, though.
Yeah.
These are very tiny monsters, which kind of makes me, like, I don't know. Like, I feel
less scared.
Yeah, because I really feel like I could fight off some tiny, tiny monsters.
Yeah, I'm not wild about the swarming idea. Like, the regular question that comes up on Reddit AMA is where would you rather fight 100 duck-sized horses or one giant horse-sized duck?
Right. I mean, I'm going to take the little things because, like, think about it. I could just push over a bookshelf on them, and I could really take out a number of them.
But being that small, they hide. They can hide everywhere. There's a point where they hide and kind of, like, marionette a teddy bear.
Yes, that's creepy.
And that was fucking creepy. I love you. But okay, so starring Katie Holmes, Bailey Madison as Sally, and Guy Pearce.
Yeah.
Who's usually great, but there are times in this movie where it feels like he's phoning it in, and it's
really
awkward.
I think he's trying to do like this. I think he probably had seen the 73 and kind of wanted to do something similar.
Yeah, I don't know that everybody was on the same page. It felt uncomfortable. I love Guy Pearce. I really
love
do.
Love Guy Pearce. Oh, my
but
God.
But this left me a little confused as to what he was going for.
The main thing I wanted to do with the movie is, on the TV movie, Sally is an adult play by Kim Darby. It's a movie that very much deals with adult female characters in a retro sort of pre-woman's lib way, so she was a mousy, mentally battered woman, and I didn't like that, and I thought, well, it would be nicer if it's a child, because then the dynamics of nobody believing her are a little more plausible.
For those of you unfamiliar, let's jump into a synopsis. A young girl who is sent to live with her father and his new girlfriend believes that she has released creatures from a sealed ash pit in the basement of her new home. I'd never even heard of an ash pit before.
Yeah,
this.
Me either.
But it's essentially like the lowest point of a fireplace. Like, it's a hole that's protected like a chimney in this remote sort of hidden basement in this house.
Right.
So Guy Pearce's character is maybe a contractor?
I think they're like house flippers or something. He restores houses.
Yeah, they're obsessed with getting on the cover of architecture magazine.
And Katie Holmes is his girlfriend that's an interior decorator.
Designer?
I
think she calls herself a designer. Yeah, but it's funny to think that Sally, the little girl, is meant to be Guy Pearce's daughter when she looks almost identical to Katie Holmes.
Yes, the whole time I'm like, wow, that looks like Katie Holmes' kid.
So we enter the story. She's being put on a plane alone at first. Guillermo del Toro has a small cameo as the passenger behind her. And so she's been traveling by herself. Her mom sends her from California to Providence, Rhode Island, H.P. Lovecraft territory. And she immediately hates it. She kind of recognizes that she's being, you know, thrown between these two parents. There are different suggestions that the parents are kind of using her to hurt one another.
Right. It seems like the mom wants pretty much nothing to do with the girl. At this point in time, she's just like, well, I'm done raising you right now, so go over there.
Yeah, she's busy doing other stuff.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of heartbreaking. And it seems like Sally takes it to heart and is, like, pretty mean to everybody. Mm-hmm. She's just kind of, like, shutting down and mean. And it's funny, there are scenes where she is kind of being nasty and obnoxious, and a lot of the time she just like stares at people, and I thought like she's just silently judging Guy Pearce's acting choices.
Oh no, I love Guy Pearce. You know, you don't shit on my Guy Pearce, my boo.
So as per the title, first of all, bad advice: do be afraid of the dark.
Yeah,
don't be afraid of the dark. Is some shit that monsters say to you to try and get you
to
go into their little corners.
Of course. I have a question for you. If you found an old house and found a hidden door where monsters behind it were talking to you and saying, like, let me out, would you open it?
Am I me now?
You are.
Or am I curious little Darren who would, like, look for his Christmas presents the month
before? You're curious, but I hope not stupid, but we'll see.
Wait, so I'm me now?
No, you're like 14. So you
14.
Have a little bit of smarts, but not a lot.
Right, yeah.
And they're saying, let me out.
Yeah, no, I think at 14, I think the more challenging thing is, like, in Sally's position where she's, I'm guessing she's in the neighborhood of, like, 8, 9 years old.
Uh-huh.
and she's alone, and here are these things
but
that
they
she
don't
refers
sound nice.
To as fairies. They don't. And I
no.
thought that would have been like more effective because they do show cunning. Mm-hmm. These little creatures do show insight as to like how to get her on their side. And
right.
so they try and pit her parents against her.
Sally's not angry. They're angry.
No, no, I'm not angry.
They don't want you. But we do.
Come down, Sally.
Come down and play.
But I thought, like, your voice is fucking creepy.
Yeah,
man.
You're creeping me out. But
this,
you know
like,
what? Honestly, probably
whisper.
Little girl me would have probably let them out just to see what would happen.
I thought it would.
I mean, I'm the one who opened the Dybbuk box here in the office.
Yeah,
so,
I know
like,
what you were thinking there.
And that was just like a couple years ago.
So, yeah, I think it would have taken us out of the story if they spoke like Goofy from the Disney Channel.
Right.
Like, oh, come on, help us out. We just want to eat your teeth.
Speaking of eating teeth, though, I love that opening scene. Oh, that's brutal. There is a great, like, tooth removal situation.
We open with the first tenant of the house, this older guy who at first you're just kind of wondering, like, why he's talking all weird.
Yeah.
And he's essentially doing what they do in terms of, like, luring people in the house
right,
into
exactly.
the basement. And then it turns out, like, he is willing to do some fucked up, creepy shit because he's been promised that he'll get his son back.
They're totally liars. Never believe little tiny monsters.
Yeah.
They're
no,
always going to lie.
You're going to want proof of life in that mm-hmm. case.
Yeah, absolutely.
I must comply.
Mr. Blackwood.
Please understand.
But yeah, that's a brutal scene. And this movie, whenever I think of this movie, pretty much whenever I think of Katie Holmes, I think of this movie and I think of the break.
Ooh.
Because it's one of the most graphic things that you see and you're like, wow. You know, it just gets you that f***ing of leg there. Woo.
Yeah, that's jumping ahead a little bit. To talk about the creatures, for Guillermo del Toro nerds who might have watched Hellboy 2, he does introduce the idea of the tooth fairies mm-hmm. in that. They are like a almost identical calcium-seeking little horde of creatures. In their case, it was much scary because they had wings. And so that's...
Oh, that's adding another level. But yeah. If you're stuck to the ground, I would just get some boots.
Well, I thought they're... I take it back. I think they're creepier in this. Yeah, actually, shell-toed shoes. Yeah,
yeah.
You just need some moon stompers. You're
yeah.
good. But so in this, to describe the tooth fairies... It's a little indelicate, but imagine like that really old lady you've met who's so hunched over.
Mm-hmm.
She has to look up. Or she has to lift her whole head to look forward.
Right.
That's what they look like.
Yeah.
Except they move with the grace of an animal, oftentimes on all fours. And so they are haunting.
Yeah, they're pretty creepy and great special effects, even though it's very CGI, but it didn't take me out of it or anything.
Yeah, there's a lot of fun stuff on the DVD or the Blu-ray showing like what was on set. Certain times they were doing sort of lighting effects that they were doing, or they would paint dots and then the actors are just mm-hmm. reacting off of nothing. But it really is done well.
Yeah.
And there's a feature that I only got long after the fact when watching the bonus content, but there's a cast of like 8 specific tooth fairy creatures who have distinct looks and personalities,
mm-hmm.
and they're meant to be the people who've been drawn into their ranks.
Okay.
So the old
that
man is represented as one of them. He's one of the more vocal ones.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can, you know, it takes a close-up, but you can see his face as mm-hmm. one of their faces.
Oh, that's great.
So it adds this next level of creepy to them in terms of, like,
if
their
they
ranks
get
are,
you, you're going to be this way.
Yeah. But I thought the relaying that information was lost on me. I didn't get that until I watched this bonus feature. But now that you,
yeah,
the listener,
know
yeah, it's worth giving it another look and keep track of the
distinct features of these creatures. Because
I did. I knew there was like big guy because they keep showing big guy and then Scraggles, which I assume is the, that's how I called him when I was watching it. And I assume he's the old man.
Okay.
Is Scraggles because he gets a lot of screen time. I don't know. I just get a big fly swatter, I think. I'm just not afraid of them that much.
They seem pretty resilient in terms of, like, coming back from any, like, being thrown off kind of moment. It's only when they're, like, thoroughly squished right. that they stay down.
One thing that I love about Guillermo is he always pulls his ideas from old folklore.
It is true, as in the screenplay, there is this writer that is very influential in me called Arthur Machen.
He believed in fairy folk, these ancient entities from the netherworld, predating mankind.
And he does propose the idea that fairies are neither good nor evil. They are just mischievous children of the earth that have a completely different set of morals.
There's a mystery about them. There's no hard and fast rules or legends about, like, do these things die at a certain age? There is a mystical ability that they can turn people into them.
In modern society, fairies have become almost elemental spirits, and they are always benign. But in ancient lore, they were children of the earth, and they are capable of great evil.
It was filmed in Australia. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that was on account of Guy Pearce, but it presented a problem when looking for a Gothic house.
Right.
It is supposed to be this sort of epic mansion that they're renovating.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And those houses don't exist in Australia. Like, they just weren't making houses of those type at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So they built a facade and they kind of could get you through the doorway, at which point it became green screen and they transitioned to an actual house. But they built a lot of that, the basement set that's all constructed from scratch. And it's gorgeous. Like, yeah. it really looks like a Guillermo del Toro film set.
It looks
set.
Really nice. Yeah.
And I guess even her bedroom looks like it has, like, fixtures that were, you know, supposed to be from the original decoration of the house.
Mm-hmm.
So her headboard looks like something that was yanked out of Pan's Labyrinth.
Right.
Like, it's really this decorative woodwork.
The set, the acting, everything is really, really set off, I think, by the music. And the music, I think, is a real nod to the 73 because it has this, like, TV kind of scored quality to it.
Okay.
And I'm not saying that to be, like, a dick. Like, I think it sounds great. And Marco Beltrami is the one who did the score for this. He's the same person who scored Mimic, Resident Evil.
Okay.
I mean, The Faculty. He even, like, did some tracks for Chinese Democracy, the GNR, but, like, it never came out. His tracks never ended up showing up.
No, of course not.
Of course, right? But, like, I don't know. I really love the score, and I love the introduction to the music, and then it's a running score for the whole film.
It incorporates one of my all-time fucking picadillos in terms of what I'm horrified at the idea of having my feet slashed.
Yes.
My Achilles tendon messed
with. I also have a great fear of that.
Yeah.
Thanks, Pet Sematary.
Fucking cage. But so they, early on, they steal Guy Pearce's straight razor. First of all, like, this is a movie in the present.
Right.
You're not a 1930s barber. Enough
no,
with the straight
also,
razor.
Also, like, everyone knows Guy Pearce looks better with a little bit of, like, scruff. Yeah, whatever.
Kim, have you seen my razor?
We have to leave in 5 minutes.
Yeah, have you seen my razor?
Here, take mine.
There's a great, like,
they have, like, a hook
miss.
From a dentist, too, as it, well. I don't know where that came from.
Yeah, that's in the bathroom gag that is, like, a direct homage to the original bathroom gag and, like, starting off hooking the light switch and turning it off. And
where did you get this?
Yeah, I really liked listening to this with headphones on because I watched it once before on Netflix. I think at the time it was on streaming. And there's a lot of subtlety in the overlapping dialogue between the creatures.
I was watching it with closed captioning.
Okay.
Because I was like, what are they saying? And it tells you everything they're saying.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's really, really nice.
What's left down here?
Wait a minute, will ya?
So that idea of, like, death by a thousand paper cuts factors in a couple times, and it's done to really brutal effect. It's funny, for a movie with a young child, this gets pretty fucking hardcore.
Yes.
And you already mentioned there is a leg snapping, and it's unexpected. And that it happens with the little girl as witness. It's just kind of like you're watching it through her eyes. Yeah. And holy God, like just kill me first. Like, don't make me watch that.
Yeah, it was really bad. And the thing that's kind of interesting is that they were aiming for a PG-13 originally.
Really?
And then it came back and it was R, no shit. But it was like almost like talked about like it was a surprise that this was going to be an R. And it's like, excuse yourself. I just watched this movie. starting out with just the teeth. Like, you're not going to get a PG-13.
Yeah, yeah. And there's, yeah, even in that very early scene, very good attention to detail is paid to the sounds of things. And when someone is, say, scraping a chisel across your teeth, like that, yeah, should make the hair on your neck stand up.
Would you like to have your Achilles tendon cut or your teeth bashed in? With a chisel and a hammer, obvs.
Teeth.
Really?
I think I'd be fine with, you know, fake teeth. I know the Achilles tendon takes forever to heal, and you're lucky if you ever get full mobility back.
Mm. You're thinking of the long run. Smart.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, neither is a vacation, you know? So without giving full spoilers, I was a little surprised at the very end, like the pre-credits. They stay true to the... Well, I'm thinking specifically in terms of like, as characters, I guess in theory, are actually revisiting the house, it's weird to think of like just a for sale sign when in reality there should be police tape.
Yeah, you know there's monsters at this house.
There should be chalk outlines.
Like, and what are you doing?
Yeah, I would never go back to that property.
No, and like this is happening on Roanoke right now too, and there's a few, I have thoughts about that, but like... don't ever step foot in the house. If you know there's also, if you know that there's monsters, burn that shit down. Yeah. You're a dick. If you sell it, like, fuck you.
Yeah, it would be like rolling up to the Amityville house and going like, oh, I forgot my glasses. I'll just go back inside.
Yeah, no. And like, P.S., you know all this bad stuff's in here. And you're just like, well, I hope someone buys it. And then they'll be like, was there any monsters living in here? And they're like, no, none that you can prove. Probably not. Don't go to the basement.
There is no sheet on a real estate agent's clipboard.
You gotta burn that down. Like, the surviving group there is kind of a bunch of jerks.
Good note to go out on. Roll credits. Is it too on the nose to say that this will be the sort of like middle slump of this episode?
Yeah. I think it's always best to like hide it in the middle. Like, you know what I'm saying? And yeah. End with a bang.
This is my first time seeing this for this episode. I do remember you specifically seeing it.
And yeah.
Not recommending it.
Nope. I didn't.
You joked very specifically about the aesthetic, and it spoke to showing the creepiness a little too well.
Way too
and
much.
Too much up front. And by that, we're talking about the mama character specifically looking like in the Simpsons X-Files episode where Mr. Burns is irradiated and wandering around in the woods. He looks like bald and glowing. And, you know, he actually looks a lot like the Munch Scream.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that. It's similarly warpy.
And it's like the X-Files episode, which is a better thing than Mama. I'd rather talk about the Simpsons X-Files episode, actually. It's great. But that is kind of what Mama looks like in this. And I was great until I really, really saw her.
Yeah.
You know, and you're along for the ride and then you're like, fuck you.
All right. So 2014's Mama, directed by Andres Muschietti. If it sounds like a familiar name, after all the shuffling and stopping and starting, he's the guy tasked with directing the It remake.
Yes, yes, which made me nervous upon revisiting Mama. Yeah. I was like, oh, Andres Muschietti and his wife Barbara were the ones who kind of wrote this.
Oh, sister. They're a brother-sister team. No, that's fine. So written by Andres Muschietti and Barbara Muschietti, and Neil Cross, who's the creator of Luther.
Yes.
Yeah. Fucking A.
Yeah. I don't know. I think he came on to do a lot of more of the English language dialogue part of it.
I could see that. Okay. So this was based on the very short film.
Yeah.
Mama, made by the same brother-sister duo. And in that short film, it's essentially one setup. And they actually use the same sort of choreography in the film. And so I think it works much better as the short film when it's expanded into the feature. I found similar frustrations to when I went to see Lights Out, and it never really grows
right
from that one dynamic, the sort of setup of the scare in the event of Lights Out. It's about something that can only live in the shadows.
Right.
And they kind of expand upon that in terms of what psychology is at play. And frankly, Lights Out is a better film, but not by a huge margin.
Sure.
So Mama doesn't really go very far beyond the original story. I like some of the components. And frankly, I like the first half of the movie.
Yeah. I like, until I can really, really see Mama, I'm like on this journey. It has things I love feral children.
Yeah.
Right? Who doesn't love that? I occasionally like a scary hair ghost aesthetic. Yeah, I don't mind that. Javier Botet, I'll watch anything he's in. That's great. You know, and like Jamie Lannister, I'll watch him for a movie. That's fine too. But all put together, it's just no good.
Yeah. So also starring Jessica Chastain. I liked her look. She looks like Brody Dale from The Distillers a little bit. And she's meant to be like this punk rocker.
Yeah. I didn't like her look.
No?
No, I didn't. That was the one where I was in the theater with my friend and I go, oh, she looks so gross. And my friend goes, she looks like you. And it's like, ugh.
And that's why she hates her. But so the story follows a sister couple. It was never intended, but they are abandoned in a house in the middle of the woods.
Right.
Their father is flown off the cuff. The implication is that after the 2008 stock market crash, he lost everything.
Right.
He lost his mind. He killed their mom. And the intention was to kill himself and the kids, although why go to the woods for that? I don't know. It's a little fuzzy.
Yeah, because it was like he was going to kill himself, but then he realized they would just die of exposure and stuff. So then he was going to, like, kill them. I don't know. I don't really know what was going on.
At that point, thank goodness for Mama. So yeah, I agree with you. I love a creepy kids story, and I think this makes it a slightly different dynamic than we typically get in terms of like cursed children or like old souls or that kind of dynamic, whether it's, you know, Damien and the Omen, or later on I'm going to talk about the kid in The Orphanage and the sort of contrast with like the Babadook. But in this case, these girls don't want to be creepy. Like, they're just the victims of this tragic circumstance.
Yeah.
And so them being feral is sheerly a matter of survival.
Right. One of my favorite parts of the movie, which honestly I could have just watched a bunch of this, was the drawings at the beginning that kind of told their story, because they're in the woods for 5 years, these girls. And you see how they're like sad at first, and then like they start eating rats, and like then they're happy about it. Then they like fight some raccoons later, and you're like, the adventures of these two girls would be phenomenal to watch.
Yeah.
And in the pictures, you actually see so much. I would have just watched a movie with that.
Yeah, and that's why the first half works, because it's more about them.
Mm-hmm.
It's more about this dynamic of their uncle who kind of inherits them. Like, he wants them.
Right.
But, you know, he's a young guy, not prepared. I already forgot her character's name, but Jessica Chastain's character is, I don't think she's his wife, right? She's just
a girlfriend. No, she's just his girlfriend.
Along for the ride, and she winds up with the kids for a large part of this, and like, she doesn't understand kids. She certainly doesn't have the like skill set to deal with traumatized children.
Right, right. And these are very special needs kids that you're like getting at this point in time. Like, no way. I would scream all the time if they kept sneaking up on me like that, which they do. That's not gonna last.
So the two girls are, I'm guessing the oldest one is in the neighborhood of like 10, right? And the other one is barely verbal. She really only says Mama.
Yeah.
And she is always in the shadow of the older sister. She's always, like, literally, you know, if the older sister was her mother, she'd be grabbing at her apron strings.
Right,
she's always
right.
in that spot, kind of, like, shying away and being shielded from, well, life.
We're very fortunate that Victoria was old enough to retain much of her vocabulary. But it's still too early to determine if resource development...
What about the other one?
That's a different story.
That little one is fucking creepy.
Oh, she's a creeper.
She is the creeper of the two.
She's
got some Renfield shit. Did you?
Yes, she likes to eat bugs. She is a bug eater. She's also the first one when we see in their like little picture journey that starts eating rats and shit. Yeah. She's like the first one to do it and be like, yeah, this is great. It's delicious. But yeah, when there's a scene in particular where she's eating these moths and she just has them all over her face and it's really gristly.
The reveal that it's bugs comes late. I really liked how they did that because when she's just got a dark smear around her mouth for, you know, the first third of the film, it could be chocolate. Like little
chocolate
kids are just
or like
messy.
Rubbing newspaper or marker all over her face. I don't know. Kids do that, I think, right?
And then it's revealed that that ain't chocolate.
No.
That's fucking black moths.
Yeah. And the black moths are specifically tied into Mama. So they're not even, like, real exactly.
Yeah, yeah, I guess. And we talked about black moths specifically as it related to Crimson Peak.
Right.
And, you know, there's a lot of lore around them, whether they're harbingers of death or, you know, notices that you can plan on winning the lottery.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure.
But in this case, there's nothing good about them except sustenance.
Yes, right? She doesn't seem to be, like, starving to death, living on cherries and bugs.
So the movie starts to kind of slip away the more CG gets used.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that Javier Botet is in this, and he's, you know, he's the very tall actor who, in a very similar way to Doug Jones, is kind of like this brilliant physical presence.
Right.
Like he moves uniquely. And I think in the original video, my guess is that that character is entirely CG, based on, like, the shape and the character. But, you know, I'm sure Guillermo del Toro wanted a little more reality that dynamic. And so it is a person acting out these roles enhanced by CG and sort of flowing, you know, Japanese horror style.
Yeah, there's a lot of hair monster kind of aesthetic to that. Going back to not only sharing these black moths with Crimson Peak, we're sharing the film score, the film composer. It's Fernando Velasquez, who did Crimson Peak. He did Mama. He did The Orphanage. Sadly, he did Devil, Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies. So it's not all great. But he also did Julia's Eyes,
if you've ever seen, another Guillermo del Toro produced.
So it's the same guy. He's kind of this composer for hire, and he makes these really beautiful film scores.
Yeah, yeah, The Orphanage especially. Yeah. I'm excited to have some of that music playing through the episode. Going back to like where the movie starts to fall short in the second half, and actually I guess earlier, because they start using CG for the little girls' mm-hmm. movement, and they want to sort of emphasize that they are feral. They are walking on all fours at times.
They can move really fast sometimes.
Yeah, but it takes you out of it. The CG is conspicuous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, it's frustrating that, like, that's where you're going to lose us. Because mm-hmm. it built up a really good atmosphere and a, you know, pretty solid aesthetic. But when you're forcing these, like, children into, like, CGI monster play, like,
I mean, because I do love the aesthetic. Oh, these kids walking on their hand, like, on four legs kind of a thing, but I don't care. And is it, like, the 20th time I saw all of Mama's face and everything, I was absolutely not interested. It was one of those movies where, and I watch movies all the time, scary movies, obvs, but I always want to, like, watch something funny after I watch a good one, you know? Because I can't go to bed right after watching it. This was when I literally walked home from the theater and went to bed. I was like, whatever. So to me, that's, like, not a good movie.
Yeah, yeah. So, I don't know. To go into more of where it goes. Yeah, I don't know.
I don't even care about the turnaround.
We've mentioned the best elements, and for that, there aren't so great. It totally worth watching the short film and then, I don't know, what, the first half of this movie?
Maybe you have to watch the whole thing if you're going to watch it.
I don't have to do shit.
I already watched it. I've now seen it twice.
Un, dos, tres, toca la pared.
The last one on this is definitely the best one, I think. 2007's The Orphanage, directed by J.A. Bayona. And this was like, this was his first film, and it's beautiful.
First feature.
And it's beautiful. Start to finish, this film is really great. We're sharing again the composer, Fernando Velasquez, who also makes this movie really what it is. This story was originally written in 1996 by Sergio Sanchez, and it sat and sat before someone actually was able to make this film.
Yeah, he wanted to make it himself, but he didn't have the clout, and no one was going to give an untested filmmaker this film to make.
And so then he kind of like eventually comes across Guillermo del Toro and says, please, please, split this movie with me, producing wise, please. And then it gets made, but it's amazing that it sits for so long when it's a really great film.
Yeah, finally coming out in 2007, this was a huge hit for Spanish cinema, and it was even Spain's entry to the Oscars for Best Foreign Language Film. Sadly, it didn't win. What could have it been competing
Probably
against that
stupid
year?
Stupid stuff.
So, a brief synopsis. A woman brings her family back to her childhood home, which used to be an orphanage for handicapped children. Before long, her son starts to communicate with an invisible new friend. That is the most like Disney-fied generic version of elevator pitches. So it is a ghost story.
Yeah.
It is a story about loss. It is beautiful. It is playful. It will break your heart.
Mm-hmm.
There are so few perfect movies made, but this is one of them.
It's beautiful. I've seen this movie, oh my God, a gazillion times. It's one of the few that I actually have a disc of.
Yeah.
Of this film, and I love it. It stars Baleen Rueda, who is also in Julia's Eyes.
Right.
And she's Laura. She's the mother. And it stars also Fernando Caio, who is in, he's like a little role in The Skin I Live In. And he is also in this really great Spanish home invasion film called Kidnapped, which is really worth checking out.
Cool. The little boy in the movie, Simon, is played by Roger Princip. And he is like equal parts adorable and natural and a really like a great actor.
Yeah, he is.
It turns out he beat out like over 400 applicants for this role and well won because he captures that element of childhood where like kids don't have much buffer. They seem their mood swing seems to vary pretty wildly.
Yes.
And so going from like loving caring to being set off. Like, you can't really hold them accountable. Like, their emotions, they don't have a lot of self-control. They're children.
Right.
And he does that, but he never enters the, like, realm of annoying that, is it Samuel from The Babadook? That's really eventually
He's
frustrating
awful.
And, irritating to watch. But Simon is perfection. He's an adorable kid.
Well, I think he also comes with a backstory that also gives you a little bit of, like, okay, we'll let a few things slide.
Mira, no soporto que digas mentiras.
Yo no miento. Tú eres la mentirosa. Tú eres la que dice que eres madre. Y no eres madre.
¿Qué quieres decir?
Tú no eres mi madre.
¿De dónde has sacado eso?
Mi amigo me lo ha dicho.
¿Quién es tu amigo?
Tomás. Tomás me ha dicho la verdad. Que yo soy como ellos. Que yo no tengo padre ni madre. Que me voy a morir. Tú no eres madre. Eres una mentirosa.
He is a character you feel sorry for because he's sick. He needs daily medicine. He needs a lot of care and a lot of doting on by his parents, I think. And so you kind of don't ever feel like he's annoying. You just feel kind of always essentially bad for him.
Yeah, yeah. And he's like an adventurous little kid. He dresses himself up like his own homemade superhero.
Yeah,
like
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, he's got a great imagination and he loves games. I was thinking just in terms of like his sort of medical background, his parents want to like renovate this home as a orphanage again. It once was when Laura was a young girl. And they want to do that again. You know, they don't have huge aspirations, but between Laura, who's like clearly a capable mother figure or mother, in stark contrast to Jessica Chastain's character, Laura, her husband is a doctor. So, they are a fully capable duo and they seem to be doing great in terms of, coming to the house with like all the best ambitions. And then things start to fall apart. There's not a lot of violence in this movie, and I think people would even fairly question whether it is a horror movie. I believe it is, but I think it's best of them.
Well, I think this is one of the greatest things about The Orphanage. You can describe the movie because the movie it's so free. You know, this is not a horror movie, a usual horror movie. It's almost a melodrama. Everything started as a horror movie, but then as we were rehearsing with the actors, we were doing a lot of research on the screenplay, and the story was so powerful, the drama was so powerful that the movie, we finally did like a melodrama, like a supernatural melodrama. And I think this is one of the greatest things about the movie.
This is actually one of the movies that like I lend out the most because this is kind of like my example of like this is how good horror can be.
Right. I mean, I think it's definitely horror. I think of it for sure as horror. And with GDT kind of tied into it, you know, it is. Yeah. It is. It really is. It's hard to talk about some of the aspects of why it is, though.
Yeah, well, we can say that so the few moments of violence stand out and like they made my skin crawl. Mm-hmm. Like they're really striking visuals, and there are a couple setups that are brilliantly executed. And you know, never too cheesy. I think the score is actually very disciplined in mm-hmm. terms of when it'll rise and fall, and even like when it's time to be playful. And there's a lot of that, and I really love those dynamics when it sort of becomes this, sort of puzzle game at times. Like, it really, I don't know, it's an enjoyable watch at those times, and so it does all the things well.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, this movie, like, I can't say enough about how much I love it. It also gives us that great un, dos, tres, toca la pared, because I say that probably every week at least. If someone knocks on the door, I'm like, uh-oh, watch out. You know what I'm thinking. And it's the best terrifying game of what is it? Red light, green light, I guess, essentially is red light, green light. And you're just like, oh, God, that's terrifying.
I guess worth mentioning, Del Toro is a huge Hitchcock fan. And I don't think he pops up in Mama. I think he was more of an exec producer in that one. Whereas in this, he gives himself like a mini cameo as an emergency room doctor. Whereas in Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, he's just a sitting passenger in the back. So like Hitchcock, I think if memory serves, Guillermo del Toro wrote a book on Hitchcock when he was in college. Like that's how much he idolized Hitchcock. And so these mini cameos are kind of like par for the course in terms of homage. There's an authenticity that we spoke about regarding Spanish films that's present here. There are no young starlets. Everyone looks their appropriate age. Even the detective involved is a middle-aged woman.
Yeah.
Because not every detective...
The aesthetic is very different in Spanish film.
Yeah. It's far more honest. Mm-hmm. Like, if this was an American one, the detective would look like, you know, every other television detective who's ready to, like, stomp down doors and pose for Abercrombie ads. Like, it's...
Yeah, no. I mean, not to say, though, that, like, Fernando Caio is not a very handsome fella.
He's okay.
To star in this.
I mean, he's handsome, but he's not, you know, he's not, like, striking. You're not wondering, like, why did he go into medicine and not modeling?
That's true.
Never
That's
a thought true. That occurred to me.
Whereas, I think definitely with, going back to Mama, Jamie Lannister, like, yeah, why is this? Not only is there one, but he's twins of like really, really handsome guys that neither one is an actor. Get out of here with that. Get out of here.
So without going into plot details, because really all you should only have your appetite whetted to want to watch this movie. Mm-hmm. I will say it shares some story components with like Peter Pan and even movies like Poltergeist.
Yeah.
And when we bring in the investigators, there's like a fair push and pull between like the corporal world and the spiritual world. And so you never go full-fledged in any one direction. Mm-hmm. I kind of like that there is always a skeptic on hand.
Yeah, fair enough.
And that said, I actually really liked the, like, well, call her the medium mm-hmm. character. And one of her parting words is, it's such a great, like, quotable line, and I'm sure it appeared on some of the posters, but the idea that
no se trata de ver para creer, sino de creer para ver.
Seeing is not believing. It's the other way around.
Crea. Entonces verá.
Believe, and you will see. And I really like that moment. It's so yeah. heartfelt when she shares it. And it's not, you know, recently we talked about the movie, The Awakening. The Awakening.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking of. Because yeah. it is, reality is kind of what you make it, or seeing, or the ability to see is up to you. This film, for very little amount of violence, got rated R, which I think
yeah.
is, I mean, but it's so small. It's so small. And Mama was PG-13.
Really?
Yeah. That should have told
that's
me a lot.
Weird difference, yeah.
But that's why I'm like, when I'm watching both of these, I see, you know, The Orphanage is one of those films that is a beautiful piece of art. And they're like, yeah. R rating for you. Don't let anyone see this. They might learn a lesson.
If they, and I'm sure they had the option, if they had taken out one visual, mm-hmm. they would have gotten the PG-13.
And I think that what we have seen right now is that the moment really works with the audience, because we try to focus in simplicity, not in, I think nowadays there is like a trend of using too many elements, like focusing the excessive, you know, and we try to put these scary moments in a very calculated way. And it, I think it really worked.
It reminded me also of a clip that I dropped into our first Guillermo del Toro episode, that regarding violence in his movies, that he's not overly worried about box office intake and, mm-hmm. you know, sort of finding the biggest audience. He says, I want to find the right audience.
Correct.
And so,
which is so Stephen King.
Yeah.
You know?
And in that way that, like, you know, I think it's fair to say Guillermo del Toro and Stephen King are two guys who, like, don't really compromise the bigger vision. And this is one that, like, it's the perfect movie because it's allowed to be what it is.
Right, right.
And yeah, I really do think this is a perfect film. You know, I was thinking about it. It kind of worries me that this would be something that film studios would want to turn into an English language film.
Someone owns it right now.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, New Line Cinema has it, I think, right now. But it's been sitting there for like almost 10 years. I mean, since they came out. And they've been talking about this. I think originally, like, Fessenden was going to be on to direct this English language. This is bizarre. It's a bizarre story. but then it didn't end up being the way he wanted to do it. So he wrote some of the screenplay. And now he's not attached to it. Someone else is. But I think hopefully it'll just sit there and die.
Yeah.
Because to do it in English language is just stupid. It's fine. It's exactly the way it really should be.
Yeah.
But I know that Guillermo del Toro had kind of a different vision in mind when he originally read the script.
Oh, really?
Versus what Bayona ended up doing with it.
Yeah.
So I think this would be closer than to Guillermo del Toro's vision of it.
I'm not strictly anti-remake at all, but when a film reaches this level of quality, I think really just, you know, fucking read the subtitles.
Yeah.
It's not a prison sentence. Just read the goddamn subtitles.
Yeah. I really don't understand why it would have to be remade. And
this was crazy successful at the box mm-hmm. office. At the time, it beat out the third Shrek movie and whatever garbage Pirates of the Caribbean came out that year. It was the biggest box office hit in Spain. And, you know, we were talking about like rating systems. I'm sure some kids went to see this.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm excited, though, for Bayona's next film, which is a Monster Calls.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's like Sigourney Weaver, and it's like so exciting.
It's getting great talk in the festival circuit. I think it comes out in December.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to. And he's made other films between these, and funny, talking about this is a good reminder that, like, I should look up some of those films.
Right.
Because this guy is one of the greats.
He obvs can make some good films. So that'll wrap it up for a really kind of quick overview of Guillermo del Toro Presents, because there's a million to choose from.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
And I guess in the past we've talked about a few. We've talked about movies like Splice.
Mm-hmm.
We were mixed between the two of us on that one.
Yeah. Yes, we were. Yes, we were. Why do you bring that up right when we're closing? You're just like, you know what I'd like to do? talk about this.
Well, what's the other one? Is it Jessica's eyes?
Julia's eyes. Who the hell's Jessica?
What are you? Are we keeping all this in?
Yeah, why not?
Happy Halloween.
Good. Yeah.
Oh, by the way.
Oh, by the way, I totally forgot. It's Halloween. Happy Halloween, everybody. As we're talking about all Spanish language film this month, and that's kind of nice.
Yeah, this was wrapping up our Día de los Muertos kind of, well, there was at least one Spanish language film, but a number of Spanish filmmakers.
Exactly, yes. Exactly. And I still have, like, more that I want to talk about. I could talk about probably a whole year on Spanish language film.
Yeah, the more we dive in, the more movies present themselves, and that was fun. There was actually a couple made in Mexico 1970s movies that I did want to talk about down the line, but that'll leave us off here.
You can follow us on social media. We are on Instagram and Facebook at The Rance Macabre. We have a Gmail at therancemacabre@gmail.com. Check out our website, therancemacabre.com, and we have extra things, artwork. You can stream the episode and some extra parts from our show.
Videos and stuff like that. And we've also got a Patreon page where you can get even more content. We've been talking up this sort of alt catalog that we've built up there between full episodes on Night of the Living Dead and Unfriended versus
The Gallows.
The Gallows.
Really? Really? You hated it that much?
I'm trying to bleach it from my mind. but lots of good stuff there at Patreon. And for a $5 and up donation, you also get the free merch pack. Well, free. You're paying for it.
But yeah.
We appreciate your help. Yeah, subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher. And check us out also on Google Play Music. We're everywhere, it seems.
It seems to be. I think we are.
Yeah.
But tonight, have a nice Halloween, and we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to The Rance Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network, produced by Darren Rosario, that's me, and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rance Macabre, contact Ken at fangoria.com. This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.